You're with us for the morning show as we learn about contact tracing for COVID-19 in Wisconsin. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. Hundreds of state National Guard soldiers are staffing 16 community testing sites in more than a dozen counties. Major General Paul Knapp said at a press briefing yesterday that the Guard members have collected more than 17,000 specimens to date.
We're ramping up quickly, and we were really excited yesterday across just the Guard teams to have such a large number, and we're on our way toward reaching that goal of 85,000 tests per week.
With stepped-up testing, more positive cases are uncovered, and then comes the work of contact tracing. What do you want to know about tracking down people who may have been exposed to the coronavirus? We're at 800-642-1234. Tracy DeSalvo is chief of the Communicable Diseases Epidemiology Section for the State Department of Health Services. Tracy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me.
So give us some 101 here about contact tracing. Exactly what is the definition for it? How does it work?
Sure. So contact tracing is really the process that we in public health use to identify people who may have been exposed to an illness, in this case to COVID-19, and then to work to prevent them from exposing other people in the future. And the process really starts when we identify someone who is a confirmed case of COVID-19. And that those individuals who are confirmed cases get what we call a case interview. And we ask them about their symptoms and their exposures, and we work to determine maybe where they became ill. But then we also ask them about people who might have been exposed to them during the time just before they became symptomatic and while they were symptomatic. And those people are their contacts. And we then, in public health, and a lot of this work really happens at the local health department level, and then we have some state staff who are supplementing that. We do work to interview those individuals who are identified as contacts, and we talk to them about what their point of exposure might have been. And then we work with them on their quarantine. We talk to them about any symptoms they might be currently experiencing and whether or not they might need to seek medical attention or testing for COVID-19.
And these case interviews, they're happening over the phone. Is that right?
Yep, they happen over the phone from local health departments or from state health department staff.
And the deputy secretary said yesterday, she said, you know, please pick up these calls. Please answer these calls. Have you noticed at all that contact tracers are not getting through to people?
I think that we have really pretty good success with reaching folks for contact tracing. But there are, of course, a portion of people who are maybe a little bit more hesitant to answer an unknown number. And we really want to encourage folks to answer our calls and to answer our questions. It really is one of the best ways that we're going to help to reduce the spread of COVID-19 in Wisconsin.
Approximately how many contact tracers are doing this work right now?
Sure. So there's significant capacity around the state and local health departments to do contact tracing. And these are public health nurses and other local health department staff who do this work routinely for other illnesses. But we've also added capacity at the state level. We've trained more than 400 state staff from a variety of agencies and from the UW system to help with contact tracing and to really supplement the efforts that are happening at the local level. And then we're also working to hire some new contact tracing staff.
We're talking with Tracy DeSalvo, chief of the Communicable Diseases Epidemiology Section for the state DHS. Taking your questions about contact tracing, what do you want to know about this effort in public health? And who is being trying to get a hold of? Have you been tracked down? Have you been exposed to the coronavirus? What was the interview like? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So, Tracy, how does this information get to the contact tracer after an exposure, after a virus has come back positive? What is the next step there?
Sure. So when the local health department does an interview with the case patient, we have an electronic disease reporting system in Wisconsin, and they enter information into that system. And then they're also able to enter information about contacts that case has into our system as well. And that system is a system that is available to state and local health department staff in public health. And we're able to use that information then to assign contact tracers to follow up with those contacts that were identified by a case.
And so this system platform is working across the state, and so health departments can all log in, if you will, to get access to who needs to be contacted.
Yep, that's right. It's a secure system for public health, and it's the system that we use for communicable disease information for all of our diseases, not just for COVID-19.
Do you discuss quarantining or social distancing, other practices during the stay-at-home order? What type of public health information do you have at that point of contact during the conversation, during that interview?
Sure. That's one of the really important pieces of it, of the interview that happens with contacts. We talk to them about what their date of exposure is that we are aware of. And one of the things I like to point out about that is we are not going to let that contact know the name of the person who they were exposed to. We really work to protect the case patient's privacy and the privacy of all the contacts as well. So they're not going to be told the name of the person who they were exposed to, but they will be told the date that we think that exposure happened. And that date is the start of their 14-day quarantine. So we'll talk to them about what the restrictions are for movement related to that quarantine, and also just talk to them about strategies to reduce exposure to other people in the community, in their household. We really want to work with them on the importance of physical distancing in the event that they would become ill.
Do you ask them as to whether they voted, for instance, in the April 7th election at the polls, or whether they congregated recently?
Sure. So case patients, when they have their interview, are asked information about whether they attended any large gatherings. And really what we're trying to do is identify sources where case patients might have had the opportunity to expose other individuals. So as we talk to case patients about their exposures, we do ask them about large gatherings, places they might have been, including things like voting.
Let's bring in a call now. Richard is here from Two Rivers. Hi, Richard.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for taking my phone call. Yeah, my question is do you do anything special to when you call and try to contact a person to make, because there's so many garbage phone numbers a person gets on their mobile phone or even their email accounts. Is there anything special you do to let them know it's a real important phone call?
Great question, Richard. Tracy?
That is a great question, Richard. So when our staff call, they will identify themselves as being from the State of Wisconsin contact tracing team. And local health department staff will certainly also introduce themselves as being from your local health department. And we're working on some caller ID solutions that might help to improve this in the future. But I understand that those unknown numbers can be difficult.
Are these contact tracers, are they working from their own homes? Are they working from centralized public health buildings? Where are they originating with this information?
Sure. So our state staff are in an effort to be safer at home and to really practice what we preach. We have these folks working out of their homes, and local health department staff are also, working in a variety of ways. But many staff around the state and local health departments are also working out of their homes doing this work.
We're talking about the work of contact tracers with a state epidemiologist who's coordinating this work. The DHS's Tracy DeSalvo is our guide. Have you received a call from a public health contact tracer because you may have come into contact with someone who's tested positive for COVID-19? What was the conversation like? What do you want to know about the work of contact tracing? Join in with your situation, your questions, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in a minute with Tracy DeSalvo here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about contact tracing in Wisconsin. The Department of Health Services, DHS's Deputy Secretary Julie Wilms-Van Dyke, explained the work at Tuesday's DHS press briefing. She said testing without tracing is ineffective.
It's not about getting you in trouble, and they are not allowed to share your personal information with anyone else. The reason they are asking these questions is to help protect the health of your friends and neighbors.
How do you think public health officials should be tracking people who test positive? What do you want to know about this work? Join in at 800-642-1234. We have Tracy DeSalvo, who's chief of the Communicable Diseases Epidemiology Section at DHS, and she stays with us. Let's take another call now. Nick is joining us from Brookfield. Hi, Nick.
Hello.
Hi.
I was wondering whether in identifying that the caller is an actual official from the health department, would there be a way that concerned citizens could call, or I'm sorry, could go onto a website or something where we could enter a passcode for our particular contact information so that when the health official calls, they would be able to say that passcode that we predetermined ourselves, so we know that it's not someone else trying to get our personal information or something else like that.
Thanks, Nick. I think that's a really great idea, and it's certainly something that I can take back as a suggestion for a better way to allow people to identify themselves and verify our identity. So thanks for sharing that thought with us.
Oh, Nancy and Verona wanted to know that if someone would miss the call from a contact tracer, what might the message be like? Would they leave a message?
Sure. So they will leave a message with the opportunity to contact us back, but we are going to try more than once. So if you miss our call, certainly please call us back at that number that we leave on your voicemail, but also know that we will try you again.
Let's take Mark now, joining us from Grand Chute. Good morning, Mark.
Morning. I'm wondering what's being done about tracing asymptomatics to find them and be right on top of it. Are there any models in any other countries or places?
Mark, thank you for that question. Tracy, what can be done to track down people who are not showing signs of the coronavirus, but, have the virus?
Sure. And that's really where the importance of, having testing happening on a more large scale is really important, especially in maybe an outbreak situation where you have, a larger group of people who are exposed. We've really found value in testing some of those asymptomatic exposed people to identify people who might be asymptomatic cases. And then just like with a case who had symptoms, we'll follow up with those asymptomatic individuals and do the case patient interview because they are positive and they are a case. And we'll, work on what their exposures were and then work to identify people that they might have exposed so that we can continue to do contact tracing, even branching out from people who are asymptomatic cases.
Mark, does that make sense?
Not quite. It doesn't seem to be an aggressive enough effort. And I wonder about transparency. Who's reporting? Where would you find current information on the status of finding asymptomatics? Is it just in the news, or is there?
Is there good tracking of asymptomatic people? I think maybe what you're asking, Tracy, is there any way to track down this data?
Sure. So we do have a good amount of data on cases on our DHS website. That's at dhs.wisconsin.gov. And we have a good amount of COVID-19 information on those web pages. Not necessarily specific information on the number of people who are asymptomatic, but really we do focus on identifying those cases as well, right? The goal is to identify as many cases of COVID-19 as possible so we can do contact tracing with them and really identify those people who might be exposed. And the goal of contact tracing really down the line is to prevent additional exposures, right? So we're looking to say, you are a person who was exposed, and we're going to give you some measures that you can put in place, quarantine and physical distancing, that will help to prevent you from spreading the illness to other people. And that's really the end goal of contact tracing, is to sort of stop the transmission once we've identified people who are positive.
We're talking with Tracy DeSalvo, who is chief of the Communicable Diseases Epidemiology Section for the state DHS, taking your questions about the work of contact tracing at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Mary Kay now, joining us from Kenosha. Hi, Mary Kay.
Good morning. I have a question about testing itself. I'd rather see more scientists go to China to find a cure for this, because what if you're negative 1 week and then you're positive the next week?
Yeah, and so, you know, basically, can the work of contact tracing end up being null and void, Tracy, if, you know, you're negative and then the next week you're positive?
Sure. Thanks, Mary Kay, for that question. I think, you know, that's a really important point, is that the test that is being done for COVID-19 tests whether or not you have the illness right now. And certainly someone could test positive today and they could test negative today and then test positive, you know, in a week. And that's part of the reason that we focus on that 14-day incubation period. And that's really the amount of time that we think it's possible after you're exposed for you to become ill. And so that's also why we use 14 days as the period of quarantine, because we know that any time during those 14 days, someone who has been exposed to COVID-19 could become sick. And so we're really asking them to reduce their exposure to others during that 14 days when they could become sick.
Tracy, are you using any smartphone apps or any type of digital tracking to track people who have tested positive?
So we are looking into some of these digital solutions. I know that there are several that are out on the market, and other states are starting to adapt them as well. So we're investigating those systems and how they could integrate with our existing disease surveillance system. And I think there will be more to come on that in the coming days.
And so currently, no, there are not any type of apps that patients would be entering in their symptoms or anything like that.
We don't currently have an app that we're using for that. One of the things that we're using from our current surveillance system is a method where case patients or contacts who have already talked to public health will be sent an email, and this would only be to someone who's already interacted with public health, so it won't come from us without sort of pre-warning. And that's a way that people can click a link and they can use their phone or their computer and they can report symptoms and they can do sort of their daily monitoring of symptoms electronically, and the public health department then sees that information.
And that email, is that the sole form of follow-up?
So that would be a supplemental way that we're doing some additional follow-up after the phone call, right? So that's okay. That email will not be your first point of contact from public health. That would be an additional follow-up.
So after lockdown restrictions are eased, once we start seeing retail stores reopening, the economy reopening, will you still be doing contact tracing when the Safer at Home order is lifted?
Yes, we definitely will. So contact tracing is one of the really core functions of public health. It's something we've been doing for a long time. We do it for other illnesses, like sexually transmitted illnesses, for things like tuberculosis. So it's something we've been doing for a long time. And especially as we start to open up the state of Wisconsin more and people are out and about more, it is going to be extremely important that we continue to focus on contact tracing and continue to make sure that people who have an exposure are doing their 14-day quarantines to reduce additional exposures happening. Contact tracing is really one of the main ways that we're going to be able to continue to keep the spread of COVID-19 low in Wisconsin after Safer at Home.
I'm sure you've learned things from doing this for STDs and tuberculosis, as you said, but can you scale it up? The sheer volume of contact tracing in this situation seems very different than the past.
Yes, it definitely is. This contact tracing effort is certainly at a different scale than what we would be doing sort of in a typical point in time. And that's really why we've supplemented the local health department capacity with our state-level staff and why we continue to hire more state-level staff to supplement that capacity. And we have had contact tracing positions posted at the state level, and we've really had a great turnout and people who are interested in those positions.
And I understand people speaking other languages, contact tracers who are bilingual, multilingual, is very important at this point.
Yeah, we really would get a lot of value from additional, you know, bilingual and multilingual contact tracers. When we have non-English speaking people to do a contact tracing or case interview with, that's really the best way to do that interview, is to be able to do that in those folks' primary language. And we do use LanguageLine as well to supplement that, but we really would love to have more bilingual contact tracers.
Well, Tracy, thank you for joining us.
Yes, thanks for having me, Kate.
Tracy DeSalvo is chief of the Communicable Diseases Epidemiology Section for the State Department of Health Services. Coming up, we talk with the theater community about how local theater companies are coping with being closed during the pandemic, what they're trying to do to survive. Do you perform with a local theater troupe? Do you volunteer for a theater production in your town? Join in at 800-642-1234 as we talk about live local theater. We'll be back to talk about it with Idle Stages right after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show as we talk community theater. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. So stages are dark, but the theater community is staying connected virtually, staying vital. Are you an actor or crew member who works on theater productions? How has the pandemic affected you? What shows have been canceled in your town? How are you making do? Join in at 800-642-1234. Jennifer Uphoff-Gray is Artistic Director of Forward Theater Company in Madison. Jen, thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
And we also have Wayne Merrick, who is Executive Director of the Eau Claire Children's Theater. Wayne, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you.
Well, Wayne, let's start with you. As you run a volunteer-led community theater, how has your organization been handling the pandemic?
Trying to plan ahead with moving targets and incomplete information. So it's been an interesting couple months. But as you mentioned, trying to stay active, involved, trying to stay ahead of it by, you know, moving shows, canceling shows, rescheduling shows, trying not to, like you said, go totally dark so that we, when we are able to be open again for the public, that we will have a product to offer.
It sounds really touch and go day to day. Who do you check in with? By the hour, yeah. What are those conversations like? Who are you checking in with?
I think it's really going off of the you know, press releases that we watch from the governor, our city county health department, internally, what we can accomplish with staff, their comfort level, what we're able to do. And it seems like we get a plan kind of in place. And then, you know, 2 hours later, there's a new press conference that changes that. So then we go back to the drawing board. A lot of that's happened just recently with our summer class offerings that, you know, we have a very robust summer program of classes that all within a week had to be moved to an online platform, which works for many, but not all types of classes, especially performance classes. So that's a challenge right there. Something we've never had to do is make those changes.
Jen, how about you? You run a professional theater company. How are you dealing with the situation?
Well, in many similar ways to Wayne, this is, you know, all of those cliches about uncharted waters and having to build the plane while you're flying it. All of those things are quite applicable in the current circumstances. We were teching and about to open the final main stage production of our season when everything shut down in March. The sets are actually still sitting there on the stage of the Playhouse at Overture Center in Madison. And so, you know, we initially were in just, you know, crisis management. How do we deal with those, you know, couple thousand ticket holders? And, you know, paying all of the artists and technicians who were involved in the show. And now we've really shifted all of our attention into planning for the season ahead knowing that there are going to be just so many factors that are completely out of our control. So we have just become, masters of flowcharts. We've got flowcharts upon flowcharts upon flowcharts of what we do, you know, in response to either, revolving stay-at-home orders, various different limitations on audience sizes. And then, of course, we're dealing with communications with all of the unions about not only some of the things like what will be allowed in terms of streaming or other virtual engagement, but also when it's going to be safe for their union members to return to work and under what protocols. So, we're juggling a lot.
I imagine, too, that, you can juggle what is happening on stage and trying to coordinate with unions and what it takes to put these productions on. But then what happens to the audience members? You know, how do you keep them safe and how do you encourage them to say when it is safe that they should come because you've got it covered?
Yeah, and I think that it's honestly, I think it's way too soon for anybody to saying what those safe conditions are going to be because we still don't know. Experts are still sorting out what they think is going to be a safe environment just for the general public. And I know that, organizations like Actors Equity, which is the National Union of Actors and Stagehands, they've engaged, a former national expert to essentially get a crash course on how theater works and then advise them on how our practices can be adapted for both audiences and artists to be safe under the current COVID circumstances. And so everyone is still really very much figuring that out. And so, hear it forward, and I can say every theater company in the country, community theaters, academic theaters, professional theaters, everyone's dealing with their own unique set of circumstances. But all of us are trying to envision, varied ways of engaging with audiences, whether it's, dramatically reducing capacity in the performance spaces to half or a third or a tenth, and whether that's fiscally sustainable, but also exploring ways to share our work, digitally to keep people both engaged and safe if that's the best choice.
Yeah, Wayne, it sounds like the word is adapting, and you found a way to run rehearsals through video conferencing, directing the musical Disenchanted. What are you doing there?
The rehearsals work well with there's a little caveat to that because nothing will ever replace the one-on-one interaction during a rehearsal. So it works fine to be in a Zoom meeting rehearsal, to be able to do read-throughs. We're able to do one-on-one music rehearsals. We've had blocking rehearsals where I've used, stand-in kitchen items for the performers to move them around like on a chessboard, like on a table. And
the salt, the pepper,
yep,
right?
Cinderella, you're the pepper. But whatever. So you do things like I've never done in 30 years as far as getting through that process. But everybody that is involved in that production knows that it may never happen. For example, and it probably won't ever happen with a live audience. It happens to be a show that the rights holder has the streaming license for, so there would be a much higher chance that this particular show could be live streamed in front of an empty auditorium. Once again, pretty counterintuitive to theater. You want that audience, you want that interplay, but if that can't be, then, the next best would be to get that live content out to the public, which is very hungry for that right now.
We're talking with Wayne Merrick, Executive Director of the Eau Claire Children's Theater. Jen Uphoff-Gray is Artistic Director of Forward Theater Company in Madison. We're checking in on how local theater groups are adapting, how they're moving forward, and what they're thinking right now amid the pandemic. With your questions as well about local theater productions, what's happening in your town, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Jen, as you work through so many flowcharts, so many what ifs, what happens to your bottom line? What about the budget? What, how do you work through that?
Thank you for asking. That is definitely what has kept myself and many of my peers awake many nights over the last couple of months. Forward's in a pretty fortunate position in that. So we just finished up our 11th season and have a track record we're really proud of having been able to finish in the black every single year, thanks to really robust audience support and donor support and some really careful budgeting. And so we have a decent reserve fund. What's kind of alarming for all of us is that, you know, after 11 seasons of finishing in the black, you know, we've been doing all kinds of projection budgets for this coming year, and all of them involve a six-figure loss. And every conversation we have, it's just about, is it a low six-figure loss? Is it a mid to high six-figure loss? And, you know, a low six-figure loss is our kind of most optimistic projection, and we all get very excited about that, which is a remarkable place to be just 2 months after being in a world where we're like, we're always going to finish in the black. You know, our reserve will get us through. Really what we're focusing on right now is how do we, spend as much of that reserve as we need to meet our other goals of keeping our staff and our artists fully employed and keeping close connections with our audience, especially our subscribers, without completely, running that reserve out. You know, we need to have some left to approach the following seasons with a sense of confidence. But, you know, you always think of your reserve as your rainy day fund. I would argue this is a torrential downpour, but that's what it's there for. And so we're really just trying to think of what's the most responsible way to approach that reserve in order to meet our other values and goals of keeping artists and audiences supported through this.
Wayne, how is Eau Claire Children's Theater doing with its budget?
I think we lucked out, as Jen mentioned, having shows in March. We had just closed a production of Mary Poppins about a week and a half before the closures. So that was fortuitous, I guess, to have that kind of a large influx of income from a show right at that time. So that will be very helpful moving forward. For good or for bad. I know people have different opinions about the payroll protection plan loan that we were able to secure one that will help us, has been helping us with payroll, but like for many businesses, obviously it's 8 weeks and it'll run out in early June. So then that will be a whole nother set of sleepless nights. What do we do moving through the summer? Mm. Adapting, like we said, summer classes to an online platform so that there will be a source of income coming in. What can we do with any shows at all? And then looking ahead to the next season with things that might not happen, like school matinees and touring shows and things like that, and how we might be able to make that up.
Wayne Merrick, Executive Director of the Eau Claire Children's Theater. We have Jen Uphoff-Gray, who is with Forward Theater Company, Artistic Director. And you, do you love participating in theater or being a supporter in the audience? What do you like about it? What do you hope for the future of theater in your town? 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're checking in on local community theater, how productions and companies are surviving right now. Are you a performer? What's life like now for you with shows being canceled? How are you getting by? Are you currently a theater subscriber? Where do you subscribe? How is the theater dealing with your current tickets? What upcoming shows are you no longer able to go to? Be part of this 800-642-1234. We have Wayne Merrick, who heads up Eau Claire Children's Theater, which has a 30-year history. Jennifer Uphoff-Gray is Artistic Director of Forward Theater Company in Madison. That's a not-for-profit professional theater company. So, Jen, I understand you've hosted some Facebook Live conversations with artists around the state. Can you share some examples of what you've been hearing from artists? How are they doing?
Yeah, not great. this is one of those sort of dominoes falling situation. Obviously work was canceled all over the place. for this current spring very, very quickly as the Safer at Home order went into place. But now future work for the year ahead is really just dropping. It seems like every day I'll get a call or an email from a colleague who's lost more work. You know, this is really one of the scariest aspects of our business that, you know, professional theater relies on freelance artists. And they, for the most part, have so little protection in a circumstance like this. You know, some companies, you know, were able to pay out contracts even if they were canceled. Some were able to give a little something. Some were able to give nothing. Every company, like I said, is in a different position with different degrees of reserves and ability to handle these things. But this is a really, really terrifying time for people whose livelihood is in the performing arts. And, you know, organizations and individuals are all just trying to come together and figure out how we can keep people afloat during this year ahead.
Wayne, I'm thinking about children's offerings in the summer and trying to connect with kids online, because theater seems to me so tactile, so in the moment, on stage, everyone there in person. How do you make that feeling alive when you're trying to do it via video conference?
I'd like to say that there's a, you know, there's a great solution to that, but I think the direction that we're getting as of actually even just this morning through, you know, DPI and through the school district is, you know, we're going to have to do our best to connect with the students, you know, for a certain number of minutes with FaceTime, you know, face-to-face interaction online, providing activities and doing the course as best as we can online. But I mean, frankly, there is no way to do that. It's just not the same. So it'll be great. You know, we'll like to say it's great. We're going to do our very best to offer them the material and an experience, but you just cannot substitute the face-to-face interaction of a group of adults, a group of kids going through the same process and feeding off of each other and just the whole theater experience. It just won't be the same. And for some people, they'll be fine and they'll go along for the ride, and others will be not as interested. And we will be finding that out in these next couple of weeks, whether people respond to that, the fact that all the summer classes for everybody, all the partners, the school district, have to be offered online.
It seems that you also have to reorient very quickly how you are able to even teach some of these skills you're trying to teach, because just to make it, to try to get across even ideas is going to be totally different.
Though, you know, anybody who's been around theater, you just know that's what makes it. It's the interplay between the director and the actors, or the instructor and the class, and you just lose a great deal of that online. So I don't want to downplay it. You know, I'd like to see people taking the classes, but you know, it will be a very different experience for them when it comes to theater classes. And we're going to do our best not to make it seem like, you know, academic school year classes, because they're used to that now for these last few months and are, I'm sure, growing a little tired of that.
Jen, do you have any suggestions for people who do want to support and want to watch productions, but, you know, you're not there in the audience and feeling that energy?
Yeah, we sent a letter out to all of our patrons yesterday, actually, talking about some of the planning we're doing for the upcoming season. And in that letter, I said something about the fact that any filmed or virtual, you know, offering from live theater, it's such a pale shadow of what we experience when we're together in the playhouse and there in the same space as the artists and with our neighbors. But it's also not nothing, you know, being able to see shows virtually is it's still storytelling, and it's still, you know, human connection, even if it's through a screen. And so there are a lot of great, offerings out there, you know, ranging from things like the National Theater Live has been every week streaming for free one of their past filmed productions. And of course, they're at a scale that, you know, few companies can touch in terms of the, you know, millions of dollars that they're spending on executing these. And those are really spectacular. But there's also a lot happening locally. Milwaukee Rep has been generating a lot of online content. A lot of other companies are doing either play readings or conversations with artists like we're doing, podcasts. We have our Theater Forward podcast that comes out every 2 weeks, but there's other companies offering that. And I think that it's all a way to get through this together, even if it's not exactly the way, you know, we all want it to be and the way we want it to return to. And so, you know, for people who are typically avid theater goers, you know, if they're in a position to do so, subscribe to your favorite company's upcoming season, you know, engage with them online, you know, make sure you're getting their emailed communications, and just stay in touch and know that all of us are going to be doing really everything we can and being as creative as our field really allows us to be in coming up with new ways to stay connected, to share stories, and to be in community as we get through this.
We're talking with Jennifer Apoff-Gray, who's Artistic Director at Forward Theater Company in Madison. Wayne Merrick here as well. He heads up the Eau Claire Children's Theater. Still time for you on Community Theater, 800-642-1234. So, Wayne, what are you doing to stay creative and fresh when there are so many, like, just hard business decisions that are really pulling you away from, I'm sure, the creativity you feed on in, you know, a local theater company?
I think that probably from a personal standpoint, probably from the, you know, the staff standpoint, is to be careful about not getting sucked into too much screen time or into reading too much. You need to step away from the press conferences and the news briefs and the constant barrage of articles about this. We're of course want to be on top of everything, but it's really hard to not see what's happening on Broadway and see what's happening in bigger markets and let that bring you down, because we, like you mentioned, we all have a unique situation with our theaters, our seating capacities, what we do, and so we will have different challenges or maybe opportunities that other places don't have, to make sure that we don't let that bog us down and, I guess, paralyze us into inaction. I guess we want to make sure we keep moving forward and decide not to just close our doors or get stuck here and we're not doing anything.
Jen, what keeps you going right now? What keeps you looking for a new flow chart?
That's a great question. You know, it's really two things, and it's all about community. First of all, the staff that I'm working with at Forward is so extraordinary, and we're having daily Zoom meetings just to brainstorm. And you know, your earlier question to Wayne about keeping the creative brain going. My God, you know. All of this planning is about as creative as I've ever had to be in my career. But the other thing that's really keeping me going is the degree to which I'm having an opportunity to talk with my colleagues, you know, around the community, around the state, and really around the country about how we're all coping with this crisis. We get so isolated sometimes as leaders of arts organizations. And to get to talk to our peers, it's very rare and really wonderful. And I've found so many opportunities to join into national and statewide calls.
Building a bigger network that didn't feel like was there before. Jen, thank you for joining us. Jen Apoff-Gray, Wayne Merrick. Jen is Artistic Director of Forward Theater Company in Madison. This is the Ideas Network.